history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. There are people who have done and endured incredible things for our country. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today is 96 years young. He's a father to four, a grandfather to 13, 30 great-grandchildren, and the first great-great-grandchild is on the way. Quite a legacy that never really would have gotten off the ground if he hadn't survived a very close call in World War II, maybe more than one. I know of one for sure. We're going to hear the story from Patch Curtis. We're sitting here in Modesto, California today, but you grew up in a place called St. David, Arizona. I bet most of our listeners don't know where St. David, Arizona is, but they know where a nearby town is. They probably heard a tombstone. Did you grow up pretending to be Wyatt Earp and those guys, or what?
We used to go to the annual El Dorado program, and they reenacted all of those horrendous events that transpired there in the early days.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of you right here, and I'll put this at hometownheroesradio.com. But you've got your hat on, and that looks like a rifle taller than you.
Yeah, it was, and I was 3 years old at that time, and I've been in love with a gun ever since. And that belonged to Mr. Pearson, our next-door neighbor, and it was a pump 22.
And you actually fired that gun at that age?
Later on, I didn't. At that age, I couldn't even pick it up.
I wouldn't think so.
Well, 4 or 5 years later, yes, I did. Out of the back kitchen door of our house.
And I just said your name, Patch Curtis, and you grew up in a place that carried your family's name because your grandfather homesteaded that land in Arizona?
That's correct. He and his brother, Samuel.
They were sent out there by Brigham Young?
That's correct, in 1881.
So they were real pioneers.
I would think so. From what they said and the records they left, they were real honest-to-God pioneers.
So what was your childhood like?
Growing up immersed in Mormon heritage with all their stories and the good and bad. Working on a cattle ranch farm, very successful farm, until September of 1926. My grandfather and his brother and all of their boy children had worked to build a concrete dam across the San Pedro River that supplied both of their farms with irrigation water. In September of 1926, there was a horrendous flood over the 100-year mark, as they talk about those flood stage things, that washed out the dam, and that washed out the ability to irrigate 100 acres of my grandfather's farm. Fortunately, I felt real good about fate and the fact that he had passed away 1 year before that happened. So he, at his demise, went out at the top of his game. He had a homestead that was operating full score. We had dairy cows, bees, cattle, grazing, and 100 acres that supplied alfalfa, wheat, and corn on a rotation basis, and that was the basis of the income. However, the real money that made that farm possible was earned earlier on in the freight business. He and his brother owned several 20-mule team freight outfits. They owned a Six Forge blacksmith shop right on the Mexican border, at the border crossing of Naco. That's where they actually earned the money that helped make those places really successful farms.
And you lost your mother when you were just 7 years old.
I was 7 years old when she passed away.
And you were an only child.
I was the only child, that's correct. And I went to live with my father moved from our house about 3/4 mile to the main ranch house to live with my grandmother, her invalid daughter, Nora, and the orphan that they took in to help with the chores around the place there. John Forrest was his name. He was about 12 years old when I moved up there with them.
You must have had a lot of chores to do, too.
I did, and resulting in a few switching down again when I failed to do it on time.
What was the toughest job around that farm that you had to do?
That's pretty hard to say. I thought they were all tough. I'd rather be doing something else, but chopping wood, picking up chips, bringing them in for starting the morning fire, collecting eggs, feeding the chickens, carrying slop to the hogs, milking cows, and doing all that kind of stuff, and bringing them up from the pasture and going down and getting the horses to bring those up when we'd want to saddle up and go chase cows.
So when you were doing all those tasks and daydreaming about your future, were you thinking, hey, someday I'm going to take over this farm? Or were you thinking, boy, I can't wait to get out of this farm?
Well, actually, I grew up thinking that that's where I'd spend the rest of my life, on that farm. And as things transpired, it didn't work out that way.
What changed? What altered that trajectory for you?
As my grandmother aged and the Depression came along, and along with the Depression was the horrendous closing of banks, which took all of the hard-earned cash that they had saved and put in the different banks, and that really put a crap into the situation. Along with that, after the Depression, along top of it came a horrendous drought situation that dried up a lot of the cattle feed and so on, which complicated the financial situation that existed there on the ranch. And the termination of that was that my father and his brother, who were running the ranch, decided that they had to part ways because there wasn't enough to support two families. The upshot of it was that my father sold his interest in the ranch there for $7,500, and he had to be off the premise by the 1st of January 1939. I was scheduled to graduate from high school on May the 18th, 1939, so I was allowed to stay on the old ranch house main building from January the 1st to May 18th. And that's what I did. I had a cow and I had some chickens and so on. Anyway, when my father left and I graduated from high school, that was the end of my idea and dream of staying there and spending the rest of my life on the ranch. I had wanted to go to the World's Fair in San Francisco that was on that year, and we enjoyed that very much. And then after about the fifth day, my father decided that it was time to go back to Arizona. And in the offing there, we had looked around for summer employment for me to work and earn a few dollars before I would go to Tucson to live my Aunt Clara and go to the U of A. Well, in the course of that, I found this job at Frieden Calculating Machine Company in San Leandro, California.
And for folks in 2017, they're saying, okay, a calculating machine. Now, what exactly does that mean? Because they've got a little phone in their pocket that does all the math they could ever want. What kind of machines were these and what were they
okay,
for?
Okay, these were a 40-pound mechanical device that set on gift talk that added, subtracted, multiplied, and divided.
And they weighed 40 pounds apiece.
And they weighed 40 pounds apiece.
Not going to stick that in your pocket.
No way. However, the thing of it was that when I went to work there, they were producing 25 of those per day. And they were finding immediate sale. Lumber yards particularly liked them for calculating board feet sales.
Sure.
And the scientific people liked it for calculating whatever they calculate. All the universities and schools liked it for their science classes, for their engineering classes, and so on, because they were more accurate, they work out many more points beyond zero than a slide rule, and so on. So they were very popular, and they sold. I took a look at my situation. I had a new suit of clothes, I had a new pair of shoes, a nice shirt, I had a new tie and a new hat. I had $40 in the bank, and if I went back down to Arizona, I'd have to live with my Aunt Clara. I wouldn't have any money. I'd have to go find another job and so on. I took a look at things and I figured, well, why would I go to Arizona and learn all about agriculture without any farm or ranch to go back to? And I talked to some of the people in the factory there and to my foreman and so on about what to do, and so I decided to stay with Freedom. I was in a movie theater at 90th and East 14th in Oakland, California on that Sunday morning, and it happened to be a wartime airplane movie on that had some famous actor in there. We only were in there maybe about 30 minutes when they turned the movie off, pulled the curtain and turned the lights on and said, "We have an announcement. All military personnel report to your headquarters immediately." And then the lights came back on and the movie came back on. Everything proceeded, but this was in the back of your mind. What is the military personnel doing being called up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, about a half hour later, they turned the lights back on and the movie went off. That's when the movie projector announcer came out on the stage and said Pearl Harbor had been bombed and so on and so on and so on. Everybody got up and left. I don't know whether the movie went on or not, but I got on a bus and went back to San Leandro. That was the start of World War II. On Monday, instead of going to work, I got on the streetcar and the bus and went down to Oakland to the Marine Corps recruiting office. You had to wait to get in there for a few minutes and so on, but I had a quick interview with the recruiting sergeant there. After I talked to him a little bit about my target shooting skill and so forth, he said, "I noticed you're wearing glasses." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Are you nearsighted?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You know, right now we're not taking people with glasses and nearsighted. I don't think it'd be worth your while filling out the application." I says, "Okay, well, thank you," and got on the streetcar and bus and went back out and went to work. So I almost got into the Marine Corps on Monday, December the 8th.
But less than a year later, the tune had changed. They needed bodies like yours, huh?
That's right. By August the 13th, I was on my way. I was in a bus on the way over to the receiving center in San Francisco where we were stripped of all our clothes. There was 100 of us down there buck naked waiting to be interviewed by a doctor. And when I got there, he said to me, "Are you bored with all this?" And I said, "I sure am."
Well, since you had tried to enlist earlier, were you excited at the prospect of joining the military? Did you have reservations?
I had always been interested in the military, and because of my three-month experience in the machine shop and being a tool-and-die apprentice, I was classified as material for the ordnance department. So I was sent to Aberdeen, Maryland for training. Basic training lasted for 6 weeks through all of the exercises and the combat courses and the obstacle courses and all that physical therapy that you go through and the training through the gas mask procedure and the mess hall procedure and cleaning your barracks and be good soldiers and marching and drilling and so on. We got into some small rowboats that were tied with a large rope to a motor launch. And there was about 10 guys in each one of these rowboats. This motor launch was to pull about a string of about 5 of these across the river to Betterton Island, where our bivouac area was. We started out okay, but the storm came up. The launch ran into a headwind. So the wind was increasing and the boats were going like this and the water was coming over the gunnels. The motor launch didn't have enough power to outperform this headwind and it looked like we might get a dunking, you know.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately, they poured on the gas and they finally inched ahead and they finally got us over to Betterton Island. But it was pretty exciting for a while. And as a result, there was about 6 inches of water in the bottom of these boats that we were in. A trip across was kind of exciting. After the basic training was completed, I was supposed to go down and start work in the machine shop for further training. The morning that I was supposed to go down there for that, I had a note there to go see Captain somebody there in another office, so I went and found him, and he said, "You, amongst others, has been selected cadre training Well, what's cadre training? That's for becoming non-commissioned officer. So, yeah, sure. I'd rather be a non-com than I would private. He says, okay. And then instead of reporting down to the machine shop, he said, do you report over here to section so-and-so for cadre training? So we had another 4 weeks of cadre training. I came out of that with a corporal's certificate.
And were you already feeling an itch to get overseas and be a part of this?
Yeah, I did. We all felt that way, you know. But this was countered by what we were being told all the time, that we're all in this together. It's a teamwork, and everyone has used to the best advantage of the Army and to handle the wartime effort wherever we could, you know.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a pep talk to do what you can where you're asked to do that. Well, in this cadre training, that's emphasized to you again, you know, that everybody do their part. So that, as far as getting into combat, it was kind of sidetracked a little bit by the immediate problem right now of getting the cadre training and using that. After this cadre school, we found out that what they were wanted to do was open an ordnance training center on the West Coast, and that we new cadre were trained to go and staff this new ordnance training center, and it was at Camp Santa Anita. It was actually the Santa Anita racetrack that has been taken over by the Army as a training center. So we all were put on an Army troop train, the whole bunch of us, and this whole train had all of the personnel that it took to staff the opening of that training center. So we crossed country in this Army troop train, and this was quite a bit of difference. In that trip east, we had gone in the first class in the sleeper cars and so on, and free meal chits down at the dining room and so on. Well, on a troop train, you were jammed in a thing four high on two sides of the aisle and a mess kitchen for just two meals a day. You'd get to go down to the mess car twice a day, and that's all. You didn't get three meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we got across the continent, and we wound up around midnight at the Santa Anita, and they offloaded us, and our bunk that night was on the floor with a couple of blankets in the horse stalls of the Santa Anita racetrack.
People still know Santa Anita, and, you know, next to the Triple Crown races, that's probably the most famous racetrack in the country. But so for these years, during World War II, there was no racing at all?
And no, they canceled all the racing, and at that track anyway, turned it into a training center. I, as a corporal, would have a group of 20 recruits that I would train. An event happened in North Africa that changed the course of my life there. What happened was there was a large ordnance regiment that was overrun by the German army and decimated. The reason this total decimation occurred was the fact that the ordnance people at that time were not being given infantry training and they weren't being armed. And so the army says, no more of this, soldier first and ordnance man second. So we set out to train all of the ordnance recruits before they got their technical training.
Patch would carry out that training and eventually receive his own opportunity to head overseas and join the 1st Cavalry Division in the Philippines. We'll hear how that unfolded, why he wanted so desperately to go overseas and fight, and how close he came to never making it home. Find photos of Mr. Curtis then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.